Thank you, Tim, very much. CETA members and guests, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. May I start by thanking CETA Director David Edwards and Associate Director Laurie Hogan for inviting me to be with you this morning. And also thank Tim for what will be able and moderating. My topic this morning is the outlook for the U.S. economy and the new U.S. administration's efforts to address the extraordinary financial, employment, output, and fiscal challenges it faces. I should confess up front that the U.S. government did not issue me with a crystal ball when it gave me my presidential commission, but I'm not alone in groping in the dark without a lighted globe. The volatility of financial markets and the speed of the spread of trouble from financial markets to the real economy around the world has confounded virtually every observer. The world will debate the causes of the financial crisis for decades. Where one stands on the question of causes, of course, has an influence on where one stands on the choice of solutions. Around the world, we're seeing similar debates on the merits of tax cuts versus fiscal stimulus, on the appropriate mix of short versus long-term programs, on the effectiveness of public versus private sector spending, on the role of creative destruction in the capitalist system versus the importance of protecting innocent bystanders from collateral damage, and so forth. But the real world cannot wait for years for researchers to come up with the answers to these questions. Policymakers need grounding for making their decisions today. American humorist James Thurber wrote a story about lemmings leaping over a cliff. And the lemmings were fleeing from, they didn't know what. It could have been a fire, it could have been a ghost, it could have been a devil, it could have been a goat, they didn't know. To Thurber, the moral of the story was, all human beings should strive to learn before they die what they are running from and to and why. So let me start with a very brief review of where we've been, and then turn to the whys and move on to the twos. Conventional wisdom dates the beginning of the recession in the United States from the crisis, from July 27, 2007. We do have a start date. When concerns about the U.S. subprime mortgage market led the Dow Jones Industrial Average to drop 450 points in a day. At that point, that was just a scary drop. Nowadays, that volatility is considered normal. Market observers were aware of potential problems with subprime mortgages, but the swiftness of the deterioration took investors by surprise, and the market for mortgage-backed securities collapsed, taking with it the market for collateralized debt obligations in general. To the extent that financial markets are about confidence and the management of risk at widely known and accepted prices, the second half of 2007 saw serious erosion of what makes those markets work. We all watched the contagion spread as borrowers and lenders deleveraged and financial institutions from the world's money center banks to your local savings and loan institution turned to governments for support. If one factor underlying the current crisis was the weakening U.S. housing market, and a second factor the financial sector volatility and credit contraction, a third factor was energy prices. In January 2007, as Tim pointed out, oil costs $48 a barrel. A year later, it had risen to $58 on its way to its July 2008 peak in the U.S. dollar 140 range. Many observers regard the combination of the weak housing sector, financial turmoil, and energy price shock as a lethal mix that got us where we are today. The National Bureau of Economic Research, our source of technical definition of recession in the United States, has pinpointed December 2007 as the month the United States went into recession, defined as a broad contraction of the economy, not confined to one sector. And the consequences, as we all know, have been severe. While our real GDP increased by 1.3% in 2008 over 2007, growth actually collapsed toward the end of the year. Our very preliminary data indicate that our real GDP decreased at an annual rate of almost 4% in the fourth quarter of 2008. Let me cite just one set of numbers that illustrates the seriousness of the decline, and those concern unemployment in the United States. In January 2008, U.S. unemployment rate was 4.9%. A year later, the rate reached 7.6%. In those 12 months, the number of unemployed persons rose by 4.1 million people. To put this in perspective, the increment to the number of unemployed persons in the United States almost equaled the entire population of Queensland. And the concerns today are that the increases in unemployment are going to continue unabated. The weekly registrations of first-time filers for unemployment benefits remains at a very scary high. turning to the responses to all this, an experienced and very successful Australian businessman told me recently that recovery begins only when it becomes clear to everybody that there is a problem. Look back in July 2007, how many people thought there was a problem? Well, I think it's very clear to everybody today that there is a problem. You could even say two problems. We might view the measures that U.S. authorities have taken as two sets of sequenced actions addressing two conceptually distinct but perilously self-reinforcing problems. First, the financial crisis, and then the recession. U.S. authorities' early responses aimed to stabilize the markets and maintain financial flows by injecting liquidity into the economy after private financial markets have lost their capacity to function normally. The Fed cut its interest rates to levels we haven't seen since the 1950s. It turned to non-traditional policy measures to ease credit. Working with Congress, the Bush administration put Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into conservatorship and established the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which has been used to recapitalize banks and partly recapitalize firms like General Motors and Chrysler. Earlier this month, our new Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, announced the Financial Stability Plan, which is designed to provide greater transparency to the financial system, bring in new capital to restart the flow of capital of credit to consumers and businesses, and create a new investment fund to finance and leverage private sector capital to facilitate the cleanup of bank balance sheets. Last week, President Obama unveiled a plan to help between 7 and 9 million U.S. households restructure or refinance their mortgages so they can avoid foreclosure. These measures are emergency steps, and they're meant to be temporary. The return of sustained private demand-driven growth at home and abroad will depend on the return to normality of the American financial sector, and I expect we'll get into that a bit in the question and answer period in view of this weekend's headlines about nationalization of the U.S. banking system. But turning from stabilization to stimulus, it's worth noting that the Fed's monetary policy decisions and the Bush administration's programs to bolster financial sector stability and growth already had potentially huge stimulative elements. All else being equal, lower interest rates should encourage expenditures on investment, housing, and durables, all of which are interest sensitive. And although persistent tightness of our credit markets has blunted the effectiveness of the lower interest rates so far, they could provide an extra boost once conditions improve. Portfolio investors are also usually sensitive to interest rates. In theory, lower rates translate into lower demand for U.S. paper, which in turn leads to a depreciation of the U.S. dollar. But flagging external markets have reduced demand for our exports, while a seismic decrease in global investors' appetite for risk has strengthened demand for U.S. Treasury paper, despite the very modest yields offered to current investors. Our exchange rate has responded accordingly. You know, in December 2007, I remember that day, that period very painfully, one Australian dollar could buy, on average, 87 U.S. cents. Last Friday, regardless of the difference in our economy's performances, one Australian dollar could buy only 64 cents. And I think that's more a reflection of this seismic retreat from risk that we see globally. So when demand falls and monetary policy's ability to pump up demand appears insufficient, fiscal policy is, of course, the other option. The U.S. budget includes two humongous automatic stabilizers that serve as sources of stimulation in times of distress, even in the absence of a fiscal package. Unemployment benefits rise and tax revenues decline, both of which increase our budget deficit. Beyond the monetary measures and the automatic stabilizers, President Bush signed the Economic Stimulus Act of 2008 that included tax rebate checks and tax breaks for equipment purchases by businesses. In the course of 2008, the administration distributed almost $100 billion to 119 million Americans as part of our tax rebate scheme. But as the rate of deterioration of domestic economic indicators accelerated, and as much of the rest of the world fell into or near close to recession, U.S. policymakers determined that circumstances called for additional action. Congress has now passed President Obama's stimulus package, the American Recovery and Investment Act. The package contains a mix of tax cuts and new outlays that the Congressional Budget Office estimates will add approximately $787 billion U.S. dollars to the U.S. budget deficit between now and fiscal year 2019, a little over a third in foregone revenues and the balance in additional spending. The Congressional Budget Office projects that for the remainder of this fiscal year, which for us ends in about 7 months, the impact will be about $185 billion U.S. dollars. In the succeeding two fiscal years, CBO anticipates impacts of $399 billion U.S. dollars and $134 billion U.S. dollars. In other words, the Act is significantly front-loaded. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act combines multiple short-term relief measures to stimulate aggregate demand. But because fiscal stimuli are one-off and boost total spending only temporarily, the Act also includes longer-term reform and investment measures designed to make the United States stronger and more competitive when we and the rest of the world emerge from the current downturn. Today, most observers are projecting that the U.S. recession could be the longest and deepest since World War II. The Conference Board predicts the United States may reach the trough in mid-2009. The Congressional Budget Office's latest projections predict recovery starting modestly in 2010, or possibly earlier, depending on how much bang we get for our stimulus package buck and how soon. The Federal Reserve's most recent analysis projects that the U.S. economy will contract by 0.5 to 1.3% this year, and that unemployment could approach 9%. The report anticipates that recovery may commence in the second half of the year, but the Fed also expresses concerns that the recovery will be both delayed and initially quite weak. The recovery could be slow for several reasons. The terms and availability of credit will remain tight as financial institutions recover. The stock of vacant houses will discourage housing construction. Foreign economies will not be in a position to deliver a boost, and households will restrain spending as they adjust to the large decline in their wealth. On the plus side, lower interest rates, the liquidity facilities now on offer, the stimulus package, and lower oil prices could all contribute to a turnaround. In addition, productivity gains over the past 15 years have set many U.S. companies to be highly competitive once the recovery starts. In the medium term, once we're on the road to recovery, the U.S. government will face a whole different set of challenges, and Tim has alluded to some of those already. First, once the threat of deflation has receded, the specter of inflation will reemerge as a result of a historically accommodating monetary policy. Second, the U.S. government will need to unwind the equity positions it now has in our financial institutions and other companies that have received extraordinary aid. Third, the administration and Congress will have to address our fiscal position. With our current fiscal year deficit projected to be the largest since World War II, we will have to find a way to trim the deficit without jeopardizing the recovery, and indeed President Obama plans to announce his hopes to do this to Congress later this week. Looking ahead on the policy side, in the financial sector, the President has pledged to reform our regulatory system to enable it to withstand shocks and to provide greater protections for consumers, investors, and businesses. Noting that our markets are global and that national efforts therefore cannot be fully effective without stronger international cooperation to implement higher standards, Treasury Secretary Geithner has pledged the United States will continue to support the work underway in the Financial Stability Forum and the G20 and to help build international consensus on reforms. In addition, as everyone knows, the administration imposed limits on compensation for senior executives of companies receiving extraordinary taxpayer-funded assistance. And then, as part of the stimulus package, Congress made the limits even more rigorous. For the longer term, President Obama has announced, we're going to examine the ways in which the means and manner of executive compensation have contributed to a reckless culture and quarter-by-quarter mentality that in turn have wrought havoc in our financial system. On climate change and the environment, the new administration describes the downturn as an opportunity to encourage long-term and sustainable growth. The stimulus package includes over $45 billion U.S. dollars for energy efficiency and renewable energy programs such as upgrading our electricity grid, greening federal buildings, and helping low-income households weatherize their homes. The package also provides about $18 billion U.S. dollars for clean water and environmental projects and includes around $2 billion U.S. dollars to explore carbon capture and storage for coal-burning power plants. In presenting his package, President Obama declared, "Now is the time to meet the challenge at this crossroad of history by choosing a future that is safer for our country, prosperous for our planet, and sustainable." On trade policy, as we all know, various Buy America clauses in the House and Senate versions of the stimulus package raised fears at home as well as abroad that the United States might be firing the first round in what could become a global trade war. President Obama stated clearly that we can't send a protectionist message. It would be a mistake at a time when worldwide trade is declining for us to start sending a message that somehow we're just looking after ourselves and not concerned with world trade. And indeed, he went to Canada as his first overseas visit this week and made the same point to the Canadians, to whom we are wedded in trade terms by NAFTA. The final text of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act stimulates that the Buy America requirement for iron, steel, and manufactured goods used in public work and funded under the Act will be applied in a manner consistent with the United States obligations under international agreements. What that means is we allow parties to the WTO's government procurement agreement and our partners in U.S. free trade agreements to compete with very limited exceptions on an equal basis with U.S. suppliers in U.S. government procurement. In addition, Congress has said that it does not mean for these restrictions to apply to our trade with least developed countries. From a practical point of view, the United States would reduce its access to global markets only at significant cost to itself. Trade is increasingly important to the U.S. economy. In 2008, we exported goods and services worth $1.8 trillion U.S. dollars. Those trillions again. That's equivalent to 13.1% of our GDP. Even more broadly, if we were to trigger some sort of international trade war that spilled over into economic relations in general, we would be extremely hurt on the investment side as well. Foreign direct investment provides significant benefits to our economy. For example, in 2006, U.S. affiliates of foreign companies employed 4.6% of the U.S. workforce, or over 5 million people. Looking ahead at the longer term, on February 5th, at an American-Australian Association dinner honoring his contributions to relations between our two countries, leading Australian entrepreneur Frank Lowy said, "I am an optimist. I believe in the future." Most Americans are optimists, too, with good reason, and it's important not to lose sight of what's going to allow us to recover and, in fact, to recover well. The World Economic Forum produces an annual global competitiveness report that measures countries' competitiveness against 12 sets of attributes. The U.S. remained the most competitive country in the world in the 2008-2009 survey. And particular strengths included our market size and sophistication, innovation, infrastructure, labor market efficiency, and higher education. Among the positive attributes of the U.S. economy, the competitiveness report underlines the importance of innovation. And the challenge for us now is to expand our capacity to innovate and regenerate. Over the past several decades, the United States has devoted about 2.6% of our GDP to research and development, which in recent years has accounted for about half of all R&D outlays in the G7 countries and about a third of the global total. President Obama's explicit commitment to enhancing U.S. competitiveness through education and R&D spending is a clear signal that we will strive to remain a global engine of innovation. We think of innovation as a particularly private sector phenomenon, and industry does provide the lion's share of R&D funding in the United States. Of the total $368 billion U.S. dollars spent in 2007, the federal government provided less than a third. But the figures do understate the government's role in innovation. First, the government undertakes or underwrites the basic research that is essential for innovation but is not of itself commercially viable. Second, government agencies themselves invent things. The U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, invented the Internet as well as stealthy aircraft. The Apollo space program brought to market freeze-dried food, cordless power tools, and water purification technology. Third, like other governments of innovating nations, the United States government creates the conditions where private innovation can flourish. For example, by providing education, protecting freedom of expression, providing legal certainty for inventors, investors, and initiators, and finally, safeguarding a system where capital is freely allocated and rewards match the risk. So let me make three points to conclude. First, the United States and Australia have an exceptionally deep and sophisticated economic relationship. This predated our free trade agreement, which has only served to encourage stronger economic ties since it came into effect 4 years ago. The current economic downturn may reduce the rate of growth of our exports to and our investment in each other's country, but when the turnaround arrives, our commercial exchanges will also rebound. Second, the current economic crisis does not mark the end of the free market system in the United States. There will be reforms, and some will be significant, but we remain a nation committed to individual freedom, and we know of no system that can deliver both choice and prosperity better than the one we have now. Third, the current crisis does not mark a retreat from globalization in the United States. Speaking at a university graduation a couple years ago, President Obama said to the students, "My advice is to stay global. As the world continues to change and we become more connected to each other, globalization will bring both benefits and disruptions to our lives. But either way, it's here and is not going away. We can try to build walls around us, and we can look inward, but we can respond by being frightened and angry about those disruptions. But that's not what we're about. We're a confident country, not a fearful one. We can meet these challenges. So with that, thank you very much.
I guess for all of us here, the case of the auto industry is something that we read about an awful lot, going cap in hand on private Learjets down to Washington.
And I really
ask the question more generally, not focusing specifically, but in a general sense, about structural reform within the US and in particular industry policy. The focus is clearly going to be on job retention. And I just wonder whether there is a firm view emanating from the U.S. administration as to its industry policy during these times.
They had a very firm view during the campaign, and it was a nuanced view that was going to call for more regulation, for example, in the financial sector, but was not really what you would call industrial policy per se. Their labor policy was leaning a little more in favor of worker rights. But they were not anticipating the issues that they would have to face today. I would say on the general issue of structural change in the United States, when we come out of this recession, the United States is going to look different in significant ways, and there will be some significant structural changes at the macro level. For one thing, we are going to have a different health system when we come out of this. We'll be healthier, and so we hope our healthcare system. Second, we're going to be less dependent on fossil fuel, and we're going to have a greener, more sustainable form of energy. And this administration has already started to send the policy signals and the incentives, such as requirements for higher fuel efficiency for automobiles, that are going to make that happen. And interesting thing to think about is, since 1973, the electricity use and the miles driven per constant dollar of GDP basically remained about the same. That's going to change. What happened on the oil and gas side is from 73 to 87, our oil and gas consumption actually decreased by 15% while GDP rose by 44%. In the next 20 years, oil and gas consumption went up 25% while GDP increased 76%. We're going to get a lot of price signals that are going to significantly turn that back around. And we're also, with the administration's commitment to climate change and reducing our emissions by 50% by 2050, we'll have a much greener economy. And finally, you know, we will keep innovating to stay competitive. And what that doesn't change the shape of the economy, but it does change which industries are up and which industries are down. So, yes, I think we will look different.
You mentioned being competitive, and there's a sense of being competitive within the U.S. and then being competitive on a global front. And I guess one issue that we all feel very strongly about in Australia is that, by and large, Australia has been a leader in relation to the reduction of trade barriers and tariff policy and protectionism. You've been very keen in your talk to make sure that you're sending the right signals, that Australia-US relations are going fantastically well and nothing will really change too much. But I do sense that for the general person in the street in Australia, there is a mixed signal that is coming out of the US administration. I mean, the Buy American campaign, we went through this several years ago about a Buy Australian campaign, and it is a strongly nationalistic campaign in that regard. I guess the question from Australian industry's perspective, and in particular Queensland, do you see some industries in particular being able to cut through a lot of this a lot of the words around protectionism, or do you actually see that there may, well, can I ask you an honest question, for an honest answer, do you actually think that there will be some industries that may be hurt at the margin?
I think Australia's industries are going to be hurt more than by the lack of credit in the exchange rate situation than they are by any erection of new trade barriers in the United States. The Buy America provisions were inserted by Congress. They were not part of the administration's package that it sent over to Congress. And so it's very much a part of the U.S. political system when you're spending the taxpayers' dollars and you are the member of Congress or the senator who's responsible for your constituency back at home, that you're going to be you always tend to be more protectionist than usually the administration does. And except for that blip during the campaign when then-candidate Obama talked about possibly reopening NAFTA, there has not been protectionist language coming out of the administration. I would say in terms of Queensland's own ability to compete, I don't see any particular new and different problems that are going to come out of whatever policies we adopt to get us out of this recession. The FTA does provide Queensland, as well as everybody else in Australia, with a real leg up. And on the manufacturer side, Australia has long been a supplier of very specialized, high-value items, such as cochlear implants to the U.S. market. For Queensland, your beef exports are going to feed our hunger for McDonald's hamburgers till the cows come home, so to speak. On the tourism side, which is another one of your enormous exports to us, with Delta and Virgin both opening additional flights to the United States, as soon as the traveling public can afford to get on those airplanes again, I think the market will bounce back. And finally, one of the gigantic exports of Queensland to the United States is education. And we have hundreds of U.S. students studying in Queensland universities at any given moment. You're offering things and educational topics from marine science to business studies that they either think that they can't get at home or they just want the experience of getting here. And to the extent the kids' parents can afford to send them, they are going to keep coming. The early word from Trade Queensland is that the numbers haven't been hit by the crunch yet, but I think we'll have to wait and see what happens next year.
Okay, Judith. Thank you very much for that. There will be an opportunity for you to question Judith when we get together after morning tea, but can you join with me in thanking Judith for her presence?